You can probably come up with the names of some of the truly rich people in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the Astors, the Rockefellers, J.P. Morgan. Add to that list John Mackey. To look at his name, you would think it was McKay, but Mackey is how it is pronounced. And the owner of that name had a pronounced effect on the mining of the rich Comstock lode of gold and silver in western Nevada. So now you know where his riches came from. Gregory Crouch tells Mackey's story in The Bonanza King, John Mackey and the Battle over the Greatest Riches in the American West. Gregory Crouch is a West Point graduate, a former infantry officer, and a military historian. His previous books include China's Wings and Enduring Patagonia. Gregory also writes books for the New York Times and other publications. Thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Was John Mackey's name one you had known for a long time?
It was not. I ran across him when I was first looking into doing a story on the Comstock lode. I'd never heard of him before. And the more I looked into him, the more fascinating of a person he became to me.
And you share the fascination quite well. You quickly make the case how big a deal he was. Why do you suppose he's so little known now?
Well, that's really ironic, and it was because he sort of never lost his good name as a businessman and a mine owner. He had come up as a common miner, just an incredible rags-to-riches story. Grew up in the Five Points neighborhood of New York, came west in the gold rush, went to the Comstock lode beneath Virginia City, Nevada, right after it was discovered, and spent the next 15 years, you know, working his way up through the mines until he became a mine owner himself. And he never lost his good name. He never chiseled on his employees' wages. He did what he could to improve working conditions. And that is totally unlike the capitalists of that era that you know today. So he felt, as he got old, he felt no need to launch this century-long public relations project to rehabilitate the family name, which is what Stanford, Huntington, Carnegie, Rockefeller, Mellon, all those guys desperately needed that makeover, and Mackey never did.
Well, so that's an interesting point. He was not like some of the people he dealt with, including Jay Gould, who defrauded lots of people over the years, and that's how they got their names. And so you really can't lump him in with the quote-unquote robber barons of the time.
No, that's true. You know, when he died, he was held up as like the highest example of our millionaires. And that, and in the context of the time, he had won his riches in fair fight with nature, right? He was a miner. He had gotten rich mining, which meant that there was no like profit. He had not taken advantage of other people in business transactions in the context of the time. Of course, the mining industry did a lot of environmental damage all over the West and such like that. But at the context of the time, he was seen as a good guy who had done it with his own two hands the hard way.
But yeah, and then we get to the hard way. The first vignette in the book is our introduction to Mackey and his partner in 1859, bedraggled in the Nevada desert. They look like they're about to drop dead from the image you paint in the book.
Well, they had mined in around Downeyville for most of the 1850s, and Mackey liked it. He would have kept washing gold forever, but for the problem of declining returns, right? The miners in the gold rush were good at it. They got the gold out of the riverbeds and the streamway sediments, and by the end of the decade, many weren't making grub, including Mackey, which meant finding enough gold to pay for their food. So when the Comstock lode was discovered, he and his partner, you know, walked from Downeyville to Virginia City. It's well over 100 miles because they were too poor to afford a mule.
Wow. So really, they walked. That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, these people in the 19th century were pretty hardcore in terms of what they would do.
So wind it back in time then, because you mentioned that Mackey was pretty much dirt poor from childhood, grew up in the rough lower section of New York, Five Points as it was known at the time. But even before that, he actually was born and spent his first few years in Ireland, is that right?
Yeah, he came, his family brought him to New York when he was nine, and they had, you know, he'd grown up in a typical one-room Irish rural cottage with, you know, a dirt floor, no windows, no internal rooms, you know, sharing the floor with the family pig. The poverty of 19th century Ireland just can't be overstated.
No, indeed it can't. So, but I noticed in the timing, though, that it looks like the Mackeys actually got here ahead of the potato famine. Is that right?
That is correct. They came in 1840, and things seem to have gone well for them for the first couple of years because Mackey went to school, and only about half of the school-age Irish children managed to attend any school at all at that time. Unfortunately, his father died 2 years later, and that forced him to go to work selling newspapers on the streets of New York, which, you know, he did until he was old enough to take an apprentice job in a shipyard as an apprentice ship's carpenter.
Did John Mackey get much schooling before he had to get out and start selling papers?
No, just those 2 years, I think. He could read and write and figure, and late in life, he always felt his lack of formal education, and he would often be found in his rooms, you know, studying school books, trying to make up for the education that he'd missed.
Yeah, how unusual. You mentioned he got hired in a shipyard. This is the William Webb Shipyard in New York City. How unusual in that Mackey got hired there?
Well, yes, there was massive amounts of anti-Irish prejudice at that time in the 1840s, particularly after the potato famine just landed waves of refugees in the eastern cities. And shipbuilding was one of the industries that typically refused to hire Irishmen. However, Mackey did catch on, I would imagine, because he had impressed somebody elsewhere in the city with good service or hard work. He was an extraordinarily hardworking guy. And, you know, he caught on. Webb was the most advanced shipbuilder in the world then. But essentially what he learned was carpentry skills and how to deal with large-scale constructions. And that would serve him well later in life.
Yeah, having to build the internal stuff to hold mines together is where it paid off. We're trying to learn more about John Mackey with Gregory Crouch, the author of The Bonanza King, John Mackey and the Battle Over the Greatest Riches in the American West. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking to Gregory Crouch, who's written a story about an interesting character of the Old West who you could say he struck it rich, but not in the way that is often romanticized as finding a big nugget in a stream or something. John Mackey was a little too late for that to get to the California Gold Rush. He ended up striking it rich in the Comstock, if striking is even the correct term. He worked really hard for a really long time. And he's profiled in Gregory Crouch's book, The Bonanza King, John Mackey and the Battle Over the Greatest Riches in the American West. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about that period in American history or some of the other colorful characters. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So I have to wonder, Gregory Crouch, the difficulty in finding sources. I mean, you have other people who are very well documented, largely because of sharp practices, the likes of the Rockefellers and J.P. Morgan and Jay Gould of that time. But somebody who played it straight, as John Mackey did, is going to create less of a record. Was he somewhat harder to research because of that?
Well, what made the real difference for me was the digitization of modern newspaper old newspaper records, the modern digitization of old newspaper records. That made it possible for me to get closer to the original material than other people have, because it was so tedious to go through the newspapers on the microfiche reels prior to recent times. You know, if you put one newspaper reel of, like, say, the Daily Alta California up there and went through 1 year, when you were done with that, the last thing in the world you'd want to do is put up the San Francisco Chronicle and go through the same year. And you're taking notes by hand. It's just very tedious. You never can get back to the original source if you have a further question. However, all the modern digitization means that I can get up the articles about the same events in a multiple browser windows in multiple newspapers. And, you know, lo and behold, 19th century newspapers have their editorial biases just like modern newspapers. So I was able to get a pretty balanced view of what had happened on a daily basis, just technologically. I mean, the stuff has obviously been there, but it's so tedious to get to under the old system, and it just isn't anymore.
Well, and speaking of newspapers, you tell the story of the news of the California gold strike. That it's interesting to read it in the context you provide, because it looks like it was poo-pooed at first by some people.
Well, I mean, yes, newspapers in the 19th century were somewhat less reliable than they are today, too. You know, news didn't travel as fast. There was many hoaxes perpetrated in American society at that time. And the fear of fake news was real. So people didn't know what to make of it when it first started filtering into the eastern states starting in the summer of 1848. You know, gold had been discovered in January of 1848, and the news doesn't really start breaking in New York until August. And it's not until the president's State of the Union address in December that it becomes why, you know, that people accept it. He'd gotten letters from army officers. Some gold had actually come back from California. It had been assayed by the mint and declared genuine. Then it became sort of incontrovertible that it did in fact exist.
So that's December 1848. The president, James K. Polk, puts it in his State of the Union address. Mackey didn't take off for California until 1851. This should be an indication of his work ethic. What held him back?
Well, I think it was two things. One, I would imagine he had promised his employer, the person for whom he was doing the apprenticeship, that he would finish his apprenticeship. So there's that. He was definitely a man of his word. He never went back on his word. And I don't think he was naturally an impulsive man either. So the people rush out to California. By 1851, when he went, he would have gone to California in the light of full knowledge. You know, Eastern newspapers had been filled with California stories for the last, you know, 2 to 3 years. It was the most exciting thing in the world at the time was the California phenomenon.
Indeed, and we're talking to Gregory Crouch about somebody who didn't strike it rich in California, but he bided his time and got rich in Western Nevada, the Bonanza King, John Mackey, and the battle over the greatest riches in the American West. Is it possible that life in a miner's camp in old California was even rougher than the squalor of New York?
That's possible, although it's hard to imagine anything more squalid than the Five Points neighborhood of New York, where the Mackeys and indeed many of the Irish in New York, or most of the Irish, lived in the Five Points neighborhood. That's the Gangs of New York neighborhood, mm-hmm. if you've ever seen that movie. I would imagine it was pretty comparable in the mining camps. What there wasn't was the influence of much women or many women in the mining camps. It was a very male society, particularly early in the 1850s.
And you mentioned that that Mackey would have been happy sticking around Downeyville, California, but the plays were getting less rich over time. So it sounds like this is a guy though who would have put up with a lot before deciding to change his circumstances.
Yeah, I think it was strictly an economic decision. He enjoyed the standard placer mining, you know, washing gold out of the riverbeds. He had great friends and stuff like that with whom he was doing it. But they weren't making enough money to feed themselves, and that forced them to make a change. And the Comstock lode right then was the new big thing, so that's where they went.
And the picture at the beginning of chapter 3 in the book speaks volumes. It's two guys in a mine, one hacking away with hammer and chisel, which really gives us a sense of what it would have been like. You spend a whole day just banging away on this thing with sometimes very little to show for it.
Yeah. You know, drifting in a mine, they were making about 3 to 4 feet of progress per day. And that would have been, you know, chisel and sledgehammer to drill a hole originally for black powder. You know, they'd load it up with a black powder charge and then blast out a foot of rock and carry it out and then repeat that process. The invention of dynamite late in the 1860s speeded the work quite a lot because it was more powerful, which meant you didn't have to drill as large diameter of a hole to move the same amount of rock.
Wow, I can imagine a lot of people who lost limbs and hearing and eyesight and all sorts of stuff in that operation, though.
The mining in general is dangerous. 19th century mining is fantastically dangerous. I was astonished at how much, you know, how many accidents there were in the mines and of what sorts. It's endless.
So who was Henry Comstock, for whom the Comstock Lode is named?
He's an odd character, and I think he's been a little badly served by history. People always seem to focus on oh, he's a feckless drunk, and all those early Washoe miners, because there was placer gold in the region around Virginia City and Gold Hill that had been known about since 1849, and people had mined it since then. But everybody sort of falls in love with them, the idea of them being a bunch of feckless drunks just working to raise enough gold to, you know, pay their buy their whiskey. But I don't see it that way. I think that they were, you know, working hard, probably like most other miners in the West, hoping for a big strike, never really making one. And sure, they had their sprees, but they when they locate this massive or incredibly valuable ore that develops into the Comstock lode, they don't really know what they have. And Henry Comstock sort of horned his way into the original partnership of two Irishmen who had made the strike. And he because he's a good salesman, he gets his name attached to the lode because he's constantly talking about it. You know, Comstock's, and people start referring to it as Comstock's mine or, you know, Comstock's lode, and it becomes the Comstock lode. And he sold out. Indeed, all those guys sold their ownership in the claims in the first season. And, of course, it develops into this incredibly valuable thing, you know, essentially the Silicon Valley of the age. In modern terms, maybe $600 billion worth of wealth came out of the Comstock lode. And he sold out for a few thousand dollars, maybe $15,000 in that first season. But you don't know what you have. And it, quite often, mining strikes look good at the surface and don't continue in depth. And, of course, he was like the butt of a million jokes because he'd sold out early, but he didn't know what was down there. They could have been hacking at the top of something that was 30 feet deep instead of the richest mining strike ever made in the United States. He just didn't know.
That's an amazing story that the Comstock, for whom the Comstock lode is named, didn't end up making a whole lot of money off of it himself. But who did is the topic of Gregory Crouch's book, which is called The Bonanza King, John Mackey and the Battle Over the Greatest Riches in the American West. It's a conversation you're welcome to join if you have some questions or comments or observations about that period in American history and the people who made that period. 800-838-3760 to join in by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So I get the sense from the book that in these days where, you know, not a lot was known about how to drill holes for exploration and that sort of thing, that there were a lot of ups and downs. And working any vein of material, you'd think, well, okay, this looks really good, and then it doesn't turn out to be that way, or this doesn't look really good at all, then it does turn out to be really good.
Yes, that's absolutely true. About 1/20th of the material in the Comstock lode, or the volume of the Comstock lode, was an ore body, could be reduced profitably. And deep mining is phenomenally expensive, so it's all about cost, right? You have to do a ton of dead work to sink the shafts to get deep. The prospecting of the drifts and the crosscuts is very expensive. You have to run the pumps, you know, buy fuel to run the pumps. It just goes on and on. If you hit a large section of profitable rock where the concentration of gold and silver in the quartz was high enough, they were fantastically valuable. So it was this great, you know, speculative capitalist venture where you were taking incredible financial risk as well as physical risk, but the payoff was enormous if you hit a good ore body.
So Mackey wasn't working in there with a claim right away. He and his friend Jack O'Brien showed up to work. Who did they work for?
Well, they went to work for the owners of the Offer Mine. Those would be the people that Henry Comstock and the other people in the original company had sold out to. You know, so Mackey went to work for $4 a day in somebody else's mine, and he started working his way up from nothing by doing a second shift of what anybody on earth would have considered hard labor every day in exchange for feet. So he's getting his pay for one shift. The second shift he's doing in exchange for feet. Now, feet was how mines were owned. If you owned a 400-foot slice of the Comstock, you had a 400-foot claim, you would have 400 shares. And originally they pertained to a single geographic foot, but that quickly was gotten rid of, and it was just, you know, a share in the mine. So Mackey earned his way into ownership with sweat equity. And you could buy and sell feet, like you could buy and sell shares in a modern company, and they go up in value and down in value based on perceptions of their future prospects. And since Mackey spent much of his life underground, miners tended to have an advantage on guys that were on the surface all the time.
Did he end up stooped over from his work or blinking at sunshine when he was out in it, that sort of thing?
No, I think he was an extremely hale and robust guy. And even late in life, that made an impression on people, you know, how sort of physically strong he was. He wasn't a big guy, but, man, he had worked hard as a young man. And that reflected in his physical presence through his whole life.
We mentioned that aside from the digging, his carpentry skills from the William Webb Shipyard in New York came in handy to help put supports into the mine shafts and all the things that were needed of carpenters then. But he was also getting some management skills along the way. Tell us about that part of Mackey's life.
Well, yes, his first promotion was from a common miner at $4 a day to a timberman at $6 a day, one of the guys that installed the supports that you mentioned. And Mackey was good at that, and people recognized his work ethic and his leadership ability. And, you know, he became a gang boss and a shift leader and an underground foreman and a foreman. And before too many years had gone by, he was a superintendent, you know, managing the operations of a mine with a slice of the ownership of those mines that he'd worked in based on the sweat equity stuff.
So you describe some of the larger context. I mean, it's easy for a guy underground to lose track of what's going on around him, but there were battles not far away between whites and Native Americans. Plus, of course, the Civil War was going on the other side of the country. Did Mackey show any interest in any of it? Was he involved in any of it?
Well, there was an Indian War in 1860, in May of 1860, because the Comstock strike had flooded what was then the Western Utah Territory and would soon become the Nevada Territory with whites or Caucasians. And, that added a ton of friction with the Paiute tribe that lived there. And some sort of very nefarious white traders trading on the California Trail seemed to have kidnapped and probably raped and abused some Indian girls. They were retaliated on by the Paiute tribe who killed these brothers. And then that escalated out of hand. That one of the brothers survived. He, told about the massacre in Virginia City without mentioning why. And so the whites sort of sent out a posse of about 100 guys to, punish the Paiutes. Sounds like they were much better equipped with whiskey and shotguns and riding mules than, war ponies, long-range mini rifles, and discipline. And the Paiutes sort of lured them into an ambush near Pyramid Lake and killed about 70 of them, which was the worst loss of white life in an Indian fight between the Seminole Wars and Custer's defeat on the Little Bighorn.
Wow, so it was a notable thing. And was Mackey involved at all?
No, he seemed to have stayed in Virginia City throughout. I would guess likely because he mistrusted the Kazai Belli. There were several other famous Indian fighters, or a famous Indian fighter in Virginia City at the time, Jack Coffee Hayes, one of the great Texas Rangers. And although he commanded the second battle of Pyramid Lake, he took no part in the first. And I would again suspect because he thought that the reason for going to war was very shallow and likely not true.
At about this point in John Mackey's life, Mark Twain enters the story. How did Mackey and Samuel Clemens meet?
Well, Sam Clemens had come west with his brother when his brother was appointed Secretary of the Nevada Territory, and Sam rushed around the territory trying to get some of its fabulous mining wealth. None of his mines came in rich or anything close, fortunately for American literary destiny. And by 1862, he had taken a job on the Territorial Enterprise, which was the leading newspaper in Virginia City. And as he told his sister, they paid him $6 a week. And he said he made 50% profit by only doing $3 worth of work.
Wow. So did Twain write about Mackey?
Not in originally, later in life he did, when they were both among the most famous Americans, but they knew each other at that time. And, you know, Twain was a reporter reporting on mining and writing, you know, what we know him from that period is the sort of fancy sketches and hoaxes that he perpetrated. But he was a mining reporter to begin with, and Mackey was an up-and-coming miner, and they knew each other and became friends and maintained that friendship through the rest of their lives.
Wow. Much more to learn about John Mackey and the battle over the greatest riches in the American West, the subtitle of Gregory Crouch's book, The Bonanza King. John Mackey struck it rich in the Comstock, but through hard, patient work. We'll learn more about the work and more about the person who did it when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Gregory Crouch, a West Point graduate, former infantry officer and military historian, about a book that gets out of the military realm and very much into the history of one person in the old American West who made a lot of money off the Comstock lode in western Nevada. The book is called The Bonanza King, John Mackey and the Battle Over the Greatest Riches in the American West. It's a conversation you're welcome to join here on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions, comments, observations, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Gregory, we were just talking about Mark Twain writing about John Mackey later in life. They'd known each other quite a while from when Twain worked in Virginia City, right nearby where Mackey was working in the mines. Let's talk about Mackey's writing, though. I gather there wasn't much of it. I don't hear his own thoughts reflected much in the book.
Well, early on, prior to 1867, you know, he was just a miner working on this in this industrial mining town. There nothing really would clue you in that he was going to become one of the richest and most famous Americans. So there isn't that much of a record that survives about his, in his voice. That begins to change by the late 1860s and 1870s, where he becomes a major object of interest. And, you know, quotes from him begin appearing in the newspapers and in other people's writings. But in the early years, I don't have much, not much survived that was directly in his voice.
How were his communication skills otherwise? He had some issues with speech, I understand.
Yeah, he had a childhood stutter, which dogged him all his life, particularly when he was angry. And so he tended not to speak very much, which often gave him the last word in a conversation because he'd be sitting there thinking about things before he'd add his two cents.
So we talked about the friend he traveled with. He came to Nevada with Jack O'Brien, who he'd worked with for several years in the gold fields in California. Was Jack O'Brien one of many? I mean, I can imagine a guy like this who really did the things he said he would do would inspire a fair amount of loyalty among people.
He did. Although Jack O'Brien, their partnership sort of dissolved in the early 1860s, and O'Brien drifted off to other mining camps. And Mackey stayed focused on the Comstock lode, and he got stupendously rich, and Jack O'Brien never did, although that friendship they maintained through their whole lives. Mackey formed two other partnerships, the first one which was very successful on a mine called the Kentuck, and then his partner on that wanted to take their raise, as it was called. If you made a big strike as a miner, you made a raise. Wanted to take his raise and go back to the East Coast, where he had a brother touting spectacular opportunities in railroad investments. So that partner went broke, and Mackey formed a partnership with three other Irishmen, William O'Brien, not related to Jack, James Clare Flood, and James Fair. And those four Irishmen invested in a mine. They did a kind of a hostile takeover of a mine called the Hale and Norcross that had fallen under the control of the Bank Ring, which were the pernicious California capitalists that had monopolized the Comstock load, or the best mines on the Comstock load, and they snuck that mine out from the bank ring's clutches, became quite profitable, and then they invested the profits from that mine into a neglected stretch of ground on the Comstock load called the Convirginia, the Consolidated Virginia Mine. And 1,200 feet beneath the streets of Virginia City, they hit what's still pretty famous in mining circles as the Big Bonanza. And it's the most concentrated ore body that's ever been found in the United States. And that made them among the richest men in the world. And since Mackey owned the lion's share of that partnership, it catapulted into stratospheric heights of wealth.
And it's hard not to be impressed with how he got there, because it does appear, again, that he was not only a fair dealer, but a guy who would be willing to work two shifts a day just to be able to increase his stake. And he didn't, he got a strike eventually, but it was after years and years of truly hard work. And then we have the other kind of people like William Sharon, who you introduce us to in the book. There was a piece of work. Was he part of that bank ring?
He was. He was the leader of the bank ring on the Comstock load. And they had gained control of most of the mines by loaning money on mine stock. So they loaned Bank of California money, and they were willing to take mining stock as collateral, which was unusual. But they insisted on receiving the proxy vote for each share of stock that they loaned on. And they quickly accumulated power in the management of mines. And that was the core of their power, not the stock ownership, but that they controlled the management of the mines so they could deal with themselves. They privately owned the mills that reduced the ore. They were not above mixing waste rock with profitable ore to increase the tonnage that was milled by their mills, because mills earned money based on tons reduced rather than the quality of the ore. They founded a huge lumber company and sold lumber to the mines that they publicly managed. And in so doing, they sort of pumped money from the public stockholders in these companies to their private pockets.
Wow. So and Mackey, did he have a face-to-face at some point with William Sharon?
Yeah, Sharon, once Mackey and his partners did this takeover on the Hale and Norcross mine, Sharon was furious that he'd lost control of it. I mean, the right to reduce its ore in his own mills was incredibly valuable, and Mackey and Fair were now going to reduce the ore in their own mills, which is self-dealing along the same lines, but nobody ever accused them of milling waste. I'll make you pack your bags out of this town, or pack your blankets out of this camp yet. And Mackey glared at him and then stammered out, well, I can do it, which was an insult to Sharon because he was a kid-gloved miner, right? He never went underground. He'd come to the Comstock in a stagecoach, and Mackey had carried his blankets and bedroll in from the mines in California. So everybody present understood the insult.
Because Mackey actually had the capability to do the kinds of things that Sharon physically couldn't
do. That's right. Sharon was a financier and Mackey was a miner. And Mackey was much beloved by the other miners on the Comstock, guys that he'd worked with since the early days. He was the one who made it the biggest by far. He's probably the most successful gold rusher, and also the single most successful Comstock miner, and also almost certainly the most successful Irish immigrant of the 19th century. But none of the people that he'd worked with begrudged him this success. He's a much beloved figure.
It's pretty amazing to think, and as you point out, the people who were the bad dealers are the ones who ended up getting a lot of the press and are better known names. But somebody who was such a straight dealer, as Mackey apparently was, didn't get a whole lot, didn't get as much anyway.
Yeah, Mackey's reputation in the 1880s and 90s was totally secure. He was one of the most widely admired Americans. And so as he got old, he felt no need to found one of these philanthropic organizations that would rehabilitate his family name. He had never lost it.
Let's talk about his family, because we haven't gotten there yet. But around the time of the big strike, and he was working on New Year's Day, 1866, here's where we meet Louise Bryant in the book. Who was she, and how did she and Mackey meet?
Well, she was a a widow at the time. She had had a terrible first marriage. She married a doctor who was a few years older than her, a few days after her 16th birthday. She has two daughters, one of whom dies in infancy. The doctor gets a profound attraction to the territorial destructive whiskey and becomes addicted to one of the two medicines that actually worked in his medicine bag, opium. So he's a feckless addict and squandering all the money that he makes in ill-formed mining speculations. He's probably abusive. And when after the first daughter dies, he disappears to a different mining camp trying to rebuild his fortune. And Louise is essentially abandoned on the Comstock lode. She had to support herself and her daughter as a seamstress, which was, you know, the lowest paid female occupation at the time. And when he comes back, when the doctor comes back, he's even more dissipated than when he left. When the surviving daughter was left in his care, she fell down the stairs and broke her pelvis, which gave her a lifelong limp, which I would imagine she had been helped down the stairway by her, you know, alcoholic rage of her father. He disappears to San Francisco, disappears again to a mining camp, dies of tetanus. And Louise is now supporting herself and her daughter on the Comstock lode, you know, with no hope of a husband's return. And her and Mackie met a couple years later, or a year and a half later, and he was smitten and, you know, courted her. That was when he was a successful mine owner, but before he had found the big bonanza. So he was not the richest man in the world at that time. But a man on his way up, and they formed a pretty good marriage, it seems to me. They had two sons together. And when Mackie, when they did hit the big bonanza and now are like the richest people in the world, you know, Mackie didn't have that much of an ambition for what to do with the wealth. He wanted to be a big operator and he liked running a powerful and successful mine and swinging great enterprise. But he didn't have like an ambition for what to do with this stunning amount of cash. His wife, however, she knew exactly what to do with it.
Oh, did she? What kinds of things did she spend it on?
Well, when Mackie was extracting the big bonanza, which was, you know, a massive engineering challenge to take this huge ore body out from, you know, well over 1,000 feet underground, and he was going to be required to be on the Comstock lode almost without break for 4 or 5 years. And she hated Virginia City because of these awful early associations. He bought her 9 Rue de Tilsit, which is a mansion in Paris. It's one of those mansions that fronts the Arc de Triomphe. It's currently the Belgian embassy. So it's literally the best address in Paris. And she starts living over there in the late 1870s with their two sons, throw in these lavish parties. And she becomes, you know, close to all these European aristocrats. She's the first rich American widely accepted in continental European society. And so she becomes like the first world's first social media celebrity because the news of her social conquest is able to come back to the United States through the transatlantic telegraph cables, which have just been laid. And they fill the society columns of 19th century newspapers. So she's like the Kim Kardashian of the 19th century.
And how did John Mackie take to all this? Was he in Paris much himself?
Well, I'm sure that they made this arrangement together. And I think, you know, Mackie had these two sons with her, and he wanted them to have all the great educational opportunities that he'd never had the opportunity to have. And he knew that the mine was going to absorb all of his interest. So he would work in the mine for about 9 months a year, and then he would get on the train, which had been the transcontinental train. It was only 8 days to New York and only another 14 days to Europe on a steamship. So he would commute to spend, you know, 2 or 3 months with his family every year. And I think there was a couple of years where he might not have been able to go at all. But once he's got this huge ore body out of the ground in 1880, that kind of flips where he was spending, you know, 9 months a year in Europe and then coming back to the United States to tend to their business interests for a couple of months. And that period where they're traveling around Europe and seeing the world's great art, Mackie became quite an aficionado of art, theater, and music. It culminates when President Chester Arthur asks him to become the special American ambassador to the coronation of the Russian Tsar, Tsar Alexander III, in 1883. And so Mackie and Louise, who are both absolute paupers as youths, represent the United States at the coronation of the Tsar, which just boggled my mind. It's impossible to imagine a further journey for two people. They were surely the two people of lowest birth at that ceremony, which wouldn't have bothered Mackie one bit, by the way.
No, probably not. But so how much was the Bonanza King worth at his peak, Gregory?
Well, he probably pulled about $25 million out of the Comstock load, and then, of course, had other successful investments after that. By the time he died, he was considered, in 1902, he was considered the fifth richest American with a fortune of around $40 or $50 million, which would have been the equivalent of about $40 or $50 billion in as a slice of the modern economy, which would also put him in fifth place. You know, so he was in sort of Mark Zuckerberg territory in terms of wealth at the time.
Wow, fascinating story and well told. The book is called The Bonanza King, John Mackie and the Battle Over the Greatest Riches in the American West. Gregory Crouch is the author and our guest. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your attention.